right, I'm going to get started. My name is Sam. I've been in the Active Directory product team since 98 when I first graduated out of school. I've been working with Active Directory since its inception. So was part of the first Windows 2000 release. And right now, I spend a lot of my time leading the Federation service, Active Directory Federation service, as well as own a series of core components in Active Directory. So I also have with me Ulf out here, who I'll introduce a little more, who's also joined us today to walk through some of the new capabilities that we have in Windows Server 2012. So today's session is about giving you a good overview about all the new capabilities that we've added in Active Directory in Windows Server 2012. So a point of caution, if I say Windows 8, it typically means Windows Server 2012, because internally we've just been so used to that that it's wired into my brain. We have a lot of slides to cover today, but in general, we'll talk a lot about the investments that we made. We'll talk about the reasons why we made those investments, and also, how many of you know what a functional level is? All right. We'll also talk about a little bit about what are the key capabilities. In Windows Server 2012, we tried really hard not to push new functional levels or tie functionality to that, because this is something that all of you have provided feedback to us. So this is an area that we keenly worked on in Windows Server 2012. In terms of what are we going to cover today? I'm going to give you a little bit of a broad overview of how we thought about planning. When we started Windows 8 planning, there was a series of things that we, in terms of data and how we looked at how we make investments. So I'll give you a little bit of an insight into that. I will also kind of focus a lot on all the feature areas that we have in Windows Server 2012, talk about some of the details. Now, one thing that you will probably see is that I have way too many slides that I won't be able to cover, but there is a particular reason for that. The goal is so that even if I can't go into the details of every aspect of those features, you have enough data for you to download the presentation and have it for a late night reading. Or if you have a skill that my wife certainly attests that I don't have, you can still be able to listen to me and understand the additional details that's on the slide, all right? Okay, let's get started. There are any questions, we do have a hashtag that's out there. So if you have questions, you can tweet them, and Ulf will be tracking these, and we'll try to get to them as much as possible. And if we can't, we do have a Q&A session, a lunch session, where we have... I'm going to be there. We're going to have Matthias, who did the Dynamic Access Control presentation, as well as Brian Poole, who runs our MSIT's AD overall identity infrastructure. And we're all three of us are going to be there, and we can answer any detailed questions. I'll also be available after the session to answer any detailed questions as well. Ulf will probably be around, as well as in the booth as well.
Sure.
So let's start in terms of thinking about the high-level areas in terms of how we really started looking at Windows 8. Now, Windows Active Directory has been there since Windows 2000. We have millions of, a lot of customers who use Active Directory. And we've had a lot of feedback from all you customers. And when we started Windows 8 planning, we looked at a whole bunch of data. And the key trends, we analyzed to understand what the key trends were. The key trends were people struggled a little bit in terms of thinking about deploying new versions of Active Directory. So we said, okay, we need to see what we can do to kind of help customers do this more efficiently and without as many errors that they seem to be hitting. The second area was about management capabilities. There was a series of things in terms of people needing to manage Active Directory, so there were a lot of requests around various features. In some cases, we added PowerShell support, but we didn't have UI support, you know, a whole bunch of them. And in some cases, you couldn't deploy the right level of environment for your applications, And this was an area that we focused on. The third key trend was more towards seeing a series of problems that we've seen with customers running Active Directory on virtualized hardware. So they run virtualized domain controllers, and they seem to be hitting a few problems. And that's also an area that we focused in terms of investing. Finally, this is something totally new. With Windows Identity Foundation and Active Directory Federation Services, we introduced this notion of claims-based access control. Now, we said, hey, it seems like people using Active Directory seem to face the same set of problems. I seem to have a lot of my information in the directory, but I can't seem to use it. And how many of you have said, hey, I've got my directory information holding something, let's say a department, and all I did was I had to write something that ran on a periodic basis to convert those people that had that attribute and add them to a group. How many of you have done something like that? There you go. So this was another key area where we've established the first aspect of introducing a much richer authorization mechanism in Windows, and we lit up the first workload, which was file server. How many of you attended the dynamic access control session yesterday? Okay, so I'm going to give you a glimpse of every area, and as much as possible, try to give you a good overview of all the investments that we've made. Now, also note that because of the sheer volume of slides that I have, we also, in the appendix of the deck, there's a lot of additional information on some of the key areas. For example, much more detailed behaviors about LDAP controls, certain things that we did to improve our RID management. Those are areas that are in the appendix of the deck. Okay, I've kind of given you a quick already summary. This just puts that into a slide. So we're going to be spending time talking about, like, virtualization, and we had a theme called easier to deploy and manage AD as part of Win 8 planning. When we did Win 8 planning, we were focused on the whole Windows division, brought in themes, and this was a key theme for us around the identity layer about easier to deploy and manage AD, and the other one was dynamic access control. Across this, I'm going to be focusing on a series of platform investments that we've made around deployment, virtualization, around various platform changes that we've made in Active Directory, as well as we're going to also focus on management, where Ulf is going to cover some of the key new features that we've provided in the management layer, and I'll finally wrap it up and summarize at the end of this presentation. All right, let's get started. Now, how many of you have gone through, how many of you know what AD prep is? How many of you like dealing with AD prep? There you go. Oh, wow, I did see one hand out there, a few hands out there. Well, we've seen a series of problems with AD prep. And customers have already given us quite a bit of grief saying that, I wouldn't expect you, Microsoft, to do this. Well, we heard your feedback, and what we did was, we took a gun and we shot AD prep in the head. We pretty much killed AD prep. How many of you run through? There you go, thank you. All right, how many of you gone through DC promo? Okay, we took that and we shot that in its head as well. All right, so how do I now promote domain controllers? Well, we built a lot of goodness in terms of our PowerShell capabilities. And we introduced new paradigms about deploying roles in Windows Server using Server Manager. So what we did was we took AD prep out of the equation, and we essentially said, let's give it a nice polished UI that is integrated with the rest of the Server Manager's experiences to make it as seamless as possible. And within that experience, we integrated the notion of how do you get the first domain controller of a new version so that you don't have to think about managing this. So what it implies is that AD prep is now integrated into your deployment experience. So when you try to promote a new replica of a replica DC In a new version of Active Directory, the system, the tools will automatically detect that, will tell you exactly what to do. And we not only did this, customers had the difficulty in having to run this in a local environment. I've got to go terminal server into my local machine, think about forest prep, think about domain prep, think about GP prep. I have to remember whether it was x64 or x86 because everything was called adprep.exe in a different folder, so people made the mistake. So these were things that we totally eliminated. We integrated it into the core deployment experience. And not only do that, we also gave the capabilities for you to run it remotely. So when you run through DC Promo, you will essentially, the DC Promo or equivalent of DC Promo in Windows Server 2012, you will see that when you promote the first machine, you will see that, hey, you've not prepared your forest or domain, and if you have the appropriate credentials, it will automatically integrate that within that experience. It will ensure that the right sequencing happens so that you do not have to worry about it. And in addition, what we did was we took that and we said that all the common errors that we've seen through our support mechanism, and there was a series of them, we've made sure that we could run validation checks through that integrated deployment experience. So we do not kick off promoting a domain controller until we feel fairly certain that all the common error patterns are handled as part of that. This is a huge improvement to the experience that we currently have today. So what did we actually do? So in terms of streamlining the deployment process, we took it and integrated it within the server manager concept and put the prerequisites within the deployment experience itself. So think of a newer DC Promo, and that is integrated with the prerequisite checking that happens in that. We did, as I mentioned, we run a series of checks as part of error condition checking, you know, for simple things as, do I have my schema FISMO available? Simple things that people make have error conditions and they trip up and they have to figure out what's going wrong. So what we've done is put in a series of tests and made sure that you get back results if there were any issues. And we only proceed after we feel certain that everything that we need to promote a domain controller is satisfied. We also now, we minimize the touch points because you can just sit on a Win8 client machine, install our SAT, and target everything against your environment because every aspect of our deployment experience is now remotable. Now, in addition, the wizard DC Promo, I remember we used to have this huge chart going through all the DC Promo pages. And anyone coming new to the Active Directory team would just spend probably an hour just trying to kind of understand what the hell is going on in that DC Promo wizard. So what we've done is we've tried to optimize the paths for the key things that people care about when promoting domain controllers and made it a lot more polished. And as I mentioned, it's fully integrated into the server manager. Gone is the day where you had this weird experience where you kind of installed domain controller, and then there'll be a small kind of pop-up that says, oh, with a link that says you're going to run DC Promo, which had to be run locally. So those days are gone where it is a fully integrated experience into server manager to promote, to set up a new forest or set up replica DCs and any domain controller deployment operation. Now, the cool thing about this is that we're continuing to kind of build all our UI infrastructure around PowerShell. So all the UI that you see out there in Windows Server 2012 is going to be based on core PowerShell commandlets that we have for deployment. So fundamentally, these are the things that we focus on really driving a much more streamlined, more efficient, less error-prone deployment experience for you so that promotion of domain controllers is a lot more of a successful operation. Of course, from a requirements perspective, it's Windows Server 2012. And for certain things, we definitely require 2003 functional level or higher. How many of you are less than 2003 or higher? All right. Excellent. How many of you are less than 2008 or higher? All right. Okay. So we're seeing more and more people change because every time I ask this question, the number of hands have dropped down. Excuse me. Now, another key thing was that there were a series of errors. If there was, this is a small improvement, but if there was a transient error that happened during DC promo, we would kind of fail. Now we're a little more resilient to that, and we retry to handle for some of the common network transient errors out there. Now, there are a few more additions that we've kind of gone in terms of improving our deployment experience. Traditionally, installed from media, when you set something up, it would run an offline defragmentation. And for those of you who have a fairly large database, a DIT, then this would potentially take time to prepare your media. Now, this is very relevant because we are in a path where Active Directory is also used in a whole bunch of our own cloud services. And this is something that was very relevant for our cloud services. And as we went towards improving some of those, then we said, hey, it seems to benefit all customers. So you see the benefits of running our own cloud services on some core Active Directory infrastructure coming into the generalized platform for us to be able to do this. So now there is an option within IFM creation to disable offline defragmentation, which of course means that you potentially have a larger DIT, but at the same point in time, it reduces the size it reduces the time for you to prepare this media. A few more things around deployment. We released ADFS 2.0 as an out-of-band Windows release, but when Windows Server 2012, we've integrated that back in as a core Windows Server role, and you get all those benefits in terms of doing providing federated services for web applications or web services right within in Windows Server 2012. There's not much has changed, but with Dynamic Access Control, there is one unique thing. How many of you remember probably talking about compound identities from Dynamic Access Control? All right. So this is unique in Windows Server 2012. The core system is capable of providing a compound identity that blends both the user's security principle as well as the computer's security principle. Now, what it gives you is that I did a demo in Build conference last year where I showed how an Azure web role authorizes a specific operation only from a domain join machine, and that is possible only through the functionality that we've added for compound identities in Windows Server 2012 and ADFS being able to utilize that and being able to project claims through SAML. All right. Moving on to virtualization safe technology. How many of you know what a USN bubble is? That's good, but that's not enough. So one of the key things about Active Directory is it's a distributed database. I love the fact that I came to join Active Directory team because I worked in distributed systems when I did grad school, and it was a cool thing to kind of do this. And I worked on some of the first replication, KCC type of areas as well. Now, the core algorithm is based on a vector clock algorithm. So when something messes up that vector clock, which virtualization platforms have the capability to do so easily, without notification to the Active Directory subsystem, our whole algorithm to converge the data over a period of time falls apart. So what it means is that if you ever did an event from a virtualization perspective, where you roll back in time without letting Active Directory know about it, you can get into a situation which is called USN bubbles. What it essentially means to you is that your data is not going to diverge. So if you created things during that period when after a snapshot was created, you are going to have divergent data where not all domain controllers will know about that data. So I do have a more detailed session. I'll give you a few more details out here, but I do have a much more detailed session right after this session at 10:15, I believe. So in what did we do in Windows Server 2012? The core capability is that we needed some way to know from a virtualization perspective if we'd ever roll back in time. So we worked with the hypervisor, with the Hyper-V team to say, is there a way for us to know about it? And that's where we introduced a new concept called VM Generation ID, which is a unique identifier, think of it as a GUID, which will change, which the hypervisor platform will change whenever it thinks that it knows that there is a potential for rolling back in time. So what we do in Active Directory is that we can see that generation ID, and we also store a copy of that generation ID in our database. And if there are mismatches between those two, we know that at that point in time, it seems that there is an event, and we can handle that. For example, whenever we do system restore from backup, we already have the core capabilities for resetting certain things so that we can converge our data. All we did was we took that capability that the hypervisor platform provided and integrated it within the directory so that we could know if there are any differences and reset ourselves when we find an event. Now, this does not mean, to be clear, this does not mean that snapshots are a valid backup restore strategy, all right? Because of the number of cases that we do see where customers get into this environment, and it is an extremely painful process for you to get out of this condition. And because to find the necessary data that has diverged is difficult, and once you find it, you have to figure out ways to rehydrate the data appropriately or recreate the data to ensure that you get the right data convergence over a period of time. Now, let's just do a pictorial view of this, is that let's assume that you are at time T1. Your DC1 has, let's call USN, which is an update sequence number, and the DC1 has an ID of A, which is an equivalent to our invocation ID, for those of you who know about that. And since the DC also creates new security principles, typically it has a RID pool from which SIDs are generated, and that is provided, that is used and exhausted every time a new security principle is created. Now, let's assume that we moved on to time T2. At this point in time, you've created another 100 users, so your USN just bumped up 100, and you've exhausted 100 RIDs from your RID pool, and you're still in IDA, and your DC2 receives all of these because it knows that DC1 with IDA, all right, I did, the last time I replicated was at 100, now it's 200, so I need to get all that data, and now I'm good to go. So DC2 receives all of that data, it's all goodness. Now let's assume that I applied a snapshot, where I'm moving back, in reality, to time T1. So the DC state is still at USN 100, ID is a RID pool of 500 to 600. However, 150 users are created. Unfortunately, based on the algorithm, only the last 50 users will actually be replicated over to DC2 because it thinks that it's up to date with DC1, with IDA, for up to USN 200. So it does not know about, it will not know about any of the users that were created through the USN sequence of 100 to 200. Which is very bad because you're going to have some users on one DC and then another set of users on another DC. So which implies the whole notion of having a consistent distributed system falls apart. Oops. All right. So in addition, a key thing is that we've now started reusing RIDs. So what happens with that is that we have a lot of potential to get two security principles with the same identifier in our system. So suddenly you will see users who are logging in will not be able to log in because in case we did replicate those users, at that point in time, because of the conflicting SIDs, the DCs will automatically disable both those accounts. So these are all potential problems that you have, fundamentally because the DC never knows that it rolled back and could not update itself to update itself and reset itself sufficiently so that the DC2 and all the domain controllers within that domain can converge over a period of time. Now, unfortunately, this is a new capability of the hypervisor platform, which we are reliant on. So you do require a hypervisor platform that is capable of generating a VM generation ID and exposing it. We use it through the driver, so it looks like a BIOS setting for pretty much on the guest DCs, exposing it to the guest machines. We are also working with other hypervisor platforms to also provide the same capability so that we're now safe. So our focus was trying to make sure that virtualizing domain controllers is not problematic and be done in a secure fashion. Now, the other aspect is that I heard a few people this in this conference, in an earlier session as well, mention things about, hey, I'm not clear if support really supports, like Microsoft supports virtualized domain controllers. The clean answer is yes, we do. All right, and we've worked with customers on various cases to essentially ensure that when they hit problems, we could recover, help them recover from that.
Sam, we just had a question which is fitting in there. Do we still say that one physical domain controller would be recommended?
Yes, we do recommend one physical domain controller for the most part, and we're still working on some specific guidance. We're trying to see if we can optimize that further where everything kind of gets virtualized. But right now, our current thinking is that there is one DC per domain that's on physical hardware. The other key thing that we're also looking at it, and I will cover a lot of these in detail at the virtualization session that's following this session at 10:15, where we'll also talk about what it means to forest recovery planning and how you could potentially use some of our newer focus and around cloning, which I will cover now. Oops, I'm going. Which is, I'm going to cover now very briefly where forest recovery also has potential for us to improve with virtualization. So what did we do? Now that we've started the focus on keeping it safe for virtualized DCs, we said, what can we do further? Because there is a growing trend of moving to virtualized hardware. How many of you have virtualized DCs, by the way? Oh, my goodness. This is hugely different from about 2 years ago when I asked the same question. This is great. Because now, hey, cloning is not great for domain joined machines. You probably all know that. But the one thing about us being domain controllers, we own the security infrastructure. So we said, what if we could actually clone a full DC, because most times you're setting up, trying to create a new domain or a new forest is a fairly low frequency event. But creating replica DCs is a high frequency event. What if we can embrace virtualization and be able to clone a domain controller, because it opens up a skew of possibilities for us? And then we said, hey, we are the security infrastructure. We can do things that no one else within the OS can. So we decided to take the OS for a ride along with us and provide cloning. And I'll show a demo in the next session as well, which is kind of cool. And is we now offer the capability of you being able to take a domain controller, you being able to authorize which domain controllers can be cloned, and take that source DC and be able to clone it into multiple copies. Now, if you think about it for a short bit, you can now start to see the potential for various scenarios. Whether it is for easy deployment because, you know, hey, it's a lot going to be a lot more simpler than having to think about IFM or promoting using running DC promo. You have, all you do is clone it and ship a VHD and bring it up, boot it up, and that's pretty much all you've done. And then you can think about it from the perspective of branch office scenarios, from the perspective of disaster recovery solutions. These are all, it opens up a slew of opportunities for customers to benefit because of cloning. Now, how does it kind of briefly work? So we just, when the Active Directory domain starts, we call it NTDS, NT Domain Services, Directory Services. We obtain the current VM generation guide. I just talked to you about it. We ask the hypervisor platform for it. It gives us an ID, and we then compare it with the database value that is stored in our own database. Now, if it is different, because there's something that the hypervisor platform is telling me that, hey, my generation ID is changed. So the domain controller automatically takes safety precautions to say it resets the invocation ID so that the replication can flow out comfortably and data can converge. And it also discards the RID pool so that it is not going to reuse RIDs in this event. So it will try to get a new RID from the RID FISMO, and this way you're going to avoid having conflicting SIDs. Then what we introduced is a cloning config file. So on the source DC, if you put a cloning config file, which you can provide a series of parameters, starting from computer name, IP addresses, your DHCP settings, or your DNS settings, there's a series of those things that you've provided. We take that and say that, all right, it seems like I'm starting up. I have a clone config file, so I need to make sure that I am going to clone myself at this point in time. We parse that file, and we configure the neural network settings. Now, as part of doing this, you do require the PDC to be Windows Server 2012. We look for the PDC, and we have a special call against that that will help us get the right security infrastructure because we're creating a new special SID for the domain controller. We handle all of that by calling the PDC. And as part of doing that, we also have an authorization check. Another thing that customers brought up to us was the fact that hypervisor admins could be different from domain controller admins. And this gives you the ability to kind of have a little more control, saying who gets to authorize and which computer is authorized to be cloned as well. So we create this new domain controller object. That's all, you know, goodness, standard stuff that's available in our config naming context. And then once that is safe, we save the clone state. We now promote a new replica. We kind of, on the back end, we use the core technology that we employed for install from media is reused, but in a different context. But we do different things with the database at this point in time. And we run specific sysprep providers. So this is an important concept for those of you interested in cloning. Now, there's a series of things in terms of initializing applications and even Windows components. As part of us taking the whole OS for the ride, we've gone and ensured that the core sysprep providers for resetting certain components are also done as part of this process. So we work with the rest of the Windows team, networking, the CERT server team, there's a series of teams that we work with to make sure that everything gets reset appropriately, and we really validated this across, like, multiple feature teams. Finally, a reboot. And that's pretty much it. And all you had to do was create a clone config file and drop it in there, copy that VHD, and then reboot it into a new virtual machine, and you have a new replica domain control. How about that? All right. Well, a few more requirements. As I mentioned, the PDC has to be Windows Server 2012 because we require it to do a few things. Another one concept that I wanted to kind of mention is that now you have to be a little careful with cloning. Now, if your prepared image has software running on it that is not capable of cloning, it's difficult for us to validate that every software from your base image can be cloned. Some of them might rely on like distributed data. There's certain things that may not work well in a cloned environment. So what we did was that by default, we have a set of applications that we think and is okay for us to be cloned. Through the cloning process, we also, when you create a new cloning config file, we validate that there's nothing else installed on the system by checking the various keys, like running exes, programs that are registered. And if there are things that we do not recognize, we actually block you at that point in time and say, do you really want to clone this type of an application as well? And if it's not the case, so that we do not try to clone and something else breaks. Now, if you have validated that it's okay for it to be cloned, you can add it into an exclusion list that will allow the cloning components within a domain controller to say, okay, you kind of, this is part of an excluded list, so I'm going to skip all of these, and because you are telling me that it's okay for me to clone that. All right, moving on. There's a series of Active Directory platform changes that we've added as well. Now, a few, some base terminology is that, because I'm going to talk about it in detail, is about root DSE mods. This is a core, think of it as an RPC call to the Active Directory, because these are specialized calls for specialized operations. They're not necessarily done based on a data model, and these are specific to Active Directory. Constructed attributes are things that the system knows how to deal in terms of knowing about different data that already exists within the directory and provides that. Similarly, for those of you who've done a bunch of LDAP programming, we have a series of controls out there that do different things, like your ability to get notifications just through the dirsync control, your ability to, let's say, do sorted searches or tree deletes. There's a series of controls out there. Similarly, we're also going to talk about certain things about RIDs. And how many of you know what a DNT is? DNT? All right. Looks like I'm actually happy because typically those are in debugging scenarios, so we'll talk a little bit about it. Now, let me get to this. We started seeing a series of cases through our support channel around where an entire forest or entire domain had depleted its RID pool, right? Today, you can create about a billion security principles in a forest, in a domain. Can you imagine you have depleted a billion without necessarily knowing how you depleted a billion? We saw this both, and strangely, we've heard about it from customers, and we also heard it from our online services team running on Active Directory, especially Exchange, that hit this condition. And frankly, we were really puzzled because this has been code that has been living there for nearly a decade, and we really couldn't figure out initially what those reasons were. And we did quite a bit of code reading, we did analysis, we debugged this in customer environments. And finally, we saw a series of things that could lead to this. What this means is the impact is really huge. What this means is that if you hit this condition, you will be forced to do a full domain migration. So that was the impact that we had to deal with a few customers. So we spent quite a bit of resources trying to research what was the issue, because this wasn't quite evident in terms of what happened out there. Now, in terms of what the failed problems were, the first was that perhaps when you try to create a user account, but for some reason, let's say as you set the user account and the password policy didn't match, it would result in a failed user account create. But we would leak a RID as part of this. Similarly, if you were trying to create a computer account but didn't have the appropriate privilege, you would leak a RID. Now, those are not very often, and it's just about one RIDs. Now, the next area is bad. Let's assume that you went and deleted your NTDS settings account. How many of you know what NTDS settings is? All right, it's the object about a domain controller. It has a series of metadata about a domain controller that lives under the computer object of the domain controller. Right? Now, if that object had an attribute called RID set references, which is required as it updates about information about the RID pool, as I was mentioning earlier. If you, by any chance, you had deleted the NTDS settings object, in Windows, we already have the capability to reincarnate, because if we don't know if you deleted this by mistake, and that machine is alive, and it will reincarnate itself. Unfortunately, that reincarnation code did not set this attribute appropriately through that reincarnation logic. Now, what happened as a result of that was whenever the RID, this domain controller needed a new RID pool, it would try to get the RIDs. It would get the RID from the RID FISMO. It would say, okay, I've got the RIDs. Now, let me update this attribute. But the attribute is not there. It would fail, discard those RIDs for whatever block size. The default block size for the number of RIDs that you get is 500. It would discard that and say, oh, I don't have any more RIDs. So let me, 30 seconds later, we'll go back to the RID FISMO and do this. And this can go on and on in that type of environment where you will be depleting 500 RIDs every 30 seconds. So this is one condition that kind of related to this. Now, to make things worse, we did not have any upper bound for RIDs. In a customer environment, we saw them having, instead of setting it to 1,000, they set it to 1,000,000. All right? So in that case, they had both these conditions that happened, which they were exhausting 1,000,000 RIDs every 30 seconds. So you can now imagine it's not too hard for you to get to 1,000,000,000 from that state. All right? So these were the problems, and we did not do a great job of also warning in terms of events as we see these RIDs being lost in the system as part of that. So you can imagine this was pretty impactful to any customer's environment. So we said, okay, what are we going to go fix? Now, some of these fixes are rolling out as updates into the down-level domain controllers as well, so that because, you know, while it's all goodness for Windows Server 2012, this was impactful enough for us to push down. We started by saying that, okay, for the base cases of our user account, in terms of deleting the user account or computer account creation failures, we took that and made sure that we were not really leaking a RID. What we did was essentially we built in an in-use reuse list that's an in-memory cache that is valid all the way through the life cycle of the domain controller. So if we fail, we would put it into an in-memory cache. And whenever we created new security principles, we look to that in-memory cache. Hey, do we have any RIDs that we can reuse? Oh, it looks like we can reuse this RID, and we reuse that. So it avoided the potential in those cases for us to still leak a RID. Similarly, DC incarnation now populates the RID reference set, which is the biggest problem, and we fixed that, and that should go away. Now, in addition, we've enforced a maximum of block size that you can do, so that in case you make a typo, you're not going to get into that state where you're trying to hand off about 1,000,000 RIDs every time. Similarly, we did a series of warnings where the system starts, as it gets to the 90% of the available RID space, it's going to start warning the administrator. So every time you get to the 90% space, it will do that. So from that point onwards, based on how many more RIDs left, it'll calculate the 90% again, and then you'll again be warned about that. So this fires will start firing a lot more frequently as you get closer to actually exhausting your RIDs. Now, there are a couple more things that we did. One was we introduced, because of this notion, we wanted to get more awareness into, if you hit this, I want you to find this a little earlier. So we created an artificial ceiling at 90% of the available global RID space, and we said, when you hit that, the system is going to actually flip itself and prevent creations of new security principles until the domain admin recognizes that and overrides that. So we do give you the capabilities for you to override, but we want that to be an explicit event. Finally, this is huge, all right? We just unlocked one more bit in our overall RID space. How many more RIDs do you think that it allows us to go to? All right, we moved from 1 billion to 2 billion at this point in time. So we've kind of unlocked a whole 1 billion RIDs. And this is to help customers who may be in customers already. But we want to make sure that this is explicit again as part of unblocking, and this is an explicit action that you have to take to do this as well. So these were all the set of capabilities that we are pushing. Some of these are already flowing through QFE mechanisms, through down-level platforms on 2K8 or higher, is what I remember. Now, moving on to a couple more items is that one of the things that we also saw was that in terms of when you make changes to the schema that requires us to create a new index or update our index, what happens is that everywhere those schema updates flow and all the DCs in about 15 minutes start deciding, all right, I'm going to start rebuilding my index. And if I have a fairly large database, that is going to take time, extract CPU cycles as part of doing that. So what it results is in a loss of performance across your whole environment when this event happens. What we did was now we've added a new heuristic to say that so we ensured that we've differing any schema index, log the events, and we allow it to be much more controlled, or if you do an update schema now trigger, so which will through the root DSC mod, you will be able to control the index creation across every domain controller, and you can roll out the way index rebuild or creation happens. A few more features out here is these aren't directly related to Active Directory, but related to the broader ecosystem that Active Directory supports within Windows, and one is known as off-premises domain join. We already had this notion of an offline domain join in Windows 7. We provided that set of capabilities. But as we worked with the Direct Access team, we looked at it and said, you know, hey, there are more customers that are looking at a scenario where if their machine, because people are mobile or they're working from home, if their machine goes down, organizations want them to be able to go to the closest store, buy a new piece of hardware, and be able to provision something and get them connected to the enterprise and be productive. Now, this was very difficult to do as part of someone else buying a machine and trying to get domain joined and connected to the environment. So we used the direct access as a key mechanism where now you can now go, the admin can create a blob. Let's assume there's some website that can provide you that blob. And all you would have to do is apply that blob and run a simple command on Windows 8 machines that will give you all the necessary group policy, certificates, domain join information. All of that is encoded into that blob, and the system knows how to boot up, reset itself, and you're back connected to DA in a seamless fashion. So that now, from then, you can provision your applications if you need to, and you can get productive pretty quickly. So this is something we refer to as off-premises domain join. Similarly, how many of you have seen the Windows 8 client demos connecting to logging into LiveID? All right, we have a few. So Windows 8 now, especially the RT versions, now has the ability for you to be able to log in. This is a feature that we actually work with the Windows client team to support because my team owns the security accounts manager infrastructure in all of Windows. So we actually provide the capabilities along Windows Live ID. But why am I talking about this here? Now, there is some relationship to it being on a connected machine, on a domain join machine. On a domain join machine, you cannot log in into a Microsoft account, or, sorry, I'm still not used to new terminology because it's live ID is just being called Microsoft account. So you can log in into a, you cannot log in on a domain join machine using a Microsoft account. However, you can gain the benefits of some of all the varying services, including a single sign-on to the various Windows Live properties, including Hotmail or Messenger. All of these types of applications can benefit by connecting your domain joined account over to one of your Microsoft accounts. So this, we give you the ability, and you can potentially do things in terms of synchronize your profile, for example. Your desktop settings could be common across your machines, or if you're allowed, your browser links can be the same across all your machines, whether it's domain join or your personal machines. So that's what we support. However, we also give the controls for the administrator to say, hey, I do not want any aspect of that. So if you set a registry setting via group policy, this will not be allowed on a Windows client machine. All right, are you with me so far? It's, you know, I'm speaking, there's quite a bit to cover. So anyone thinks that I should slow down? All right, thanks. There are a few more things as part of a thing. Now we have this interesting infrastructure in the Windows client because we can know if you are connected to a live or a Microsoft account, or it's part of a local account, and we have this ability. Now, however, there's a series of core APIs within the Windows structure. LSA lookup set, LSA lookup name, there's a series of these things, if you're an application, that we have to ensure that worked appropriately. So we will provide the right set of name choices, and we provide more controls within those APIs to do the right thing if you're an application developer. A few more things, DNTs. This is a great aspect to kind of debug. DNTs are things that, think of them as rows in our database. Think of them as row numbers in our database. It's an atomically increasing sequence, and this is very useful when you're examining the database. So we can, in really close debugging scenarios, we tend to, especially for our support teams, they tend to examine the database, the DIT file, and ensure that we can understand where changes are and be able to examine specific things. So we provided a little more set of things so that it's easier to examine the database. That's part of improving this. Similarly, we've done a series of things to enhance our logging across the system. Now, for a bunch of these, a lot more details are there in the appendix of the deck because, for example, we do have a specific batch extended LDAP operations, so which implies if you were using these controls, then if you can simulate a transaction across different data objects as part of using this control and be able to, as a programmer, you might say, I want to commit everything together, or I do not, I want to roll back that whole aspect where none of the subcommits are essentially are truly committed to the database. So these are things that we also added based on specific feedback that we've had from customers. So, and moving on to management, so a couple of things is that we do have, I'll come back and talk about some of the last few things out here, but I position those last things, especially dynamic access control, right at the end because I expected people to have gone to the dynamic access control session. If you haven't, I will provide you a quick overview if you have time. And if not, you can always come to the Q&A session that we have at lunch today, or you can find me after the Q&A and lunch session on that. So now I'd like to hand off to Ulf, who will be covering and potentially showing you a few things around some of the core management functionality that we have enhanced in Windows Server 2012.
Thank you. Yeah, so my name is Ulf Simon Wittner. I'm working for Computer Center in Germany and cover European and global customers with Active Directory questions. I actually got into Active Directory at the end of 98 and was fascinated about the technology. Windows 2000 was called Windows NT5 back at those days. It was a very early alpha release. And it was a great thing, so I really thought, yeah, let's dive into this. So we have a lot of coverage here on Twitter. Thank you, everybody. It's terrific. And we I tried to answer most of the sessions, most of the questions. I'm not sure if I got covered each of them. So one is for Sam later, if we cover upgrades here from the main controllers, maybe we are able to get into this. Sam actually gave me, so we are 50 minutes into the presentation now. Sam told me I can spend like 10 to 15 minutes on the next third of the slides. I try to fasten it a little bit up. What do you think if we look into it instead of showing 10 more slides?
And someone just mentioned that they need coffee as well to keep up with me, so yes, I do need my coffee as well because this is smack in the middle of my sleeping time in Seattle.
So, that's right. And I've been doing presentations at TechEd for like 6 years now, and what's very different is to find the right level. Like you always have to start at a 200 level to get the first people into there and then increase. So we just had notions that this session is more on a 400 level right now. I try to calm down a little bit now. Sam was providing us with a lot of solutions to problems. Most of you probably never knew that you even had. Who was aware that they have issues with just a limit of 1 billion RIDs?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And you really had issues with it, or you just knew it? Okay, gladly. So actually what happened there, they just got rid of the possibility to issue negative RIDs, so you would never need them. So let's look over to the, I'm doing a quick demo here instead of talking too much, and we don't need Twitter right now. So if you have questions, wait a little bit. I won't be able to answer right away. And let's over. So we have the Active Directory Recycle Bin. Get rid of this one. I have Active Directory Administrative Center here, and this is actually a create overdone interface now. You are able to increase forest level, domain levels. You are also able to roll them back under certain scenarios, but you need to use the PowerShell here. And for example, in Windows Server 2008 R2, we got Active Directory Recycle Bin. And what this is doing, I will cover more closely tomorrow in my session. We will look at the NTDS database, showing the DNTs, what Sam mentioned before, how this is working together with the Active Directory database and Recycle Bin. So come to my session tomorrow afternoon if you're interested here. So let's see, I have a deleted objects container here. Right now in the GUI, I'm able to enable the recycle bin here. I already enabled it before the show, but you're able to raise the levels here, enable recycle bin, everything in the GUI. You don't need to remember those PowerShell commandlets for those tasks. If I go into the deleted objects container, which is only visible after I introduce the recycle bin, I see that I have two objects here which got deleted. I have a OU called Amsterdam, and I have Joe Doe, which is one of my standard test users. No offense taken if he exists. And I have the possibility here to restore the user, to a different parent. So the OU where the user was coming from, where it was deleted originally, needs to exist if I want to restore him into this OU, or I can restore him to some other OU. And this is everything supported in the GUI here. And what I also can do is I can locate the parent to see if the OU is in the existing part of Active Directory or if it's in the deleted part. So in this case, I can see Joe Doe was in the Amsterdam OU, so I might want to restore this one first. And afterwards, I'm able to restore Joe to his original location. And if I go into my users, Amsterdam OU is back, Joe Doe is back, he's back with all settings. And as I said, we'll try to recover into recycle bin and recovery tomorrow in SAA 319, the evolution of object of Active Directory recovery. So next feature is the history viewer.
Is that most customers kind of said, it's like, oh, you know, this is great, but I wanted it to be in a nested, undelete thing, all right? I think we totally get it, but the challenge for us was that within the finite amount of time that we had was that we had truly, as we investigated that further, we had to really account for the fact that in some cases, we do not know what the intention is because you might have deleted a set of users underneath that you truly want to delete, but you went and deleted the OU. And what you truly want is an undo feature, which is a last known undelete, you know, is part of that. And that was challenging for us to do within Windows Server 2012, but we'll keep it in mind.
Yeah, that's kind of transactional undelete that you say the last operation needs to be undone, but this OU was around for ages. But I will actually cover those things also tomorrow if we want to go there more into depth. So another thing what we have new in Active Directory now or in the Active Directory Administrative Center, and I actually forgot to mention this in the beginning, this demo environment is running on Server Core only. So I have the Server Manager, I have Active Directory Administrative Center, everything on my client here, and there are only Server Core domain controllers. So we have a history viewer here. So if you want to do those commands, what I just did in the GUI, if you want to write your scripts around it to do more complex operation or operations across multiple domain controllers, stuff like this, you're able to look into the history viewer, what you've just done. It's the Active Directory Administrative Center is calling some PowerShell command, and this is listed down here, and you can always flip it up and see what the commands were, and then you can write your own scripts around this. So that's also a great feature, inherited, or the Exchange group had it first, now it's in here too. I think it's very good to have a consistent thing here. Also, in Windows Server 2008, we started to provide fine-grained password policies, meaning that we can separate what passwords how often administrators are supposed to exchange passwords as opposed to service accounts, opposed to regular users. And sometimes we have limitations from OS390 host systems or something, and we want to maintain the same password policies across those systems. And so our regular users have pretty unsecure passwords or password policies, but our administrators or service accounts should be highly protected. So in Windows Server 2008, we didn't have any graphical user interface to do this. We had to go into actually ADSI Edit was the graphical user interface, which is way too technical for most people. So in Windows Server 2008, I was adding the password settings container here, which is underneath the settings object. I was putting this here right in the navigation node to navigate there more easily. And you can actually say here, new password settings, and then you get an interface here, which is actually translating all the values what you would put into the real object. It's translating it for you and makes it very easy to administer those. You can also see where those password settings are applying to. So it's way easier to create password policies now and also to see where are they applying and to manage all those things. Okay, so we actually skipped a lot of slides now. They are still in the slide deck, and actually the AD product group, Sam and his colleagues, made a very great deal here. I'm DS MVP for years, and I really enjoy if we get this depth level of information about all the LDAP controls, about RIT, and so on. So it's a great slide deck here, and as Sam mentioned before, there are many things to take away for after the session. We are not able to cover everything here because we have like 100 slides. Usually with a session length of 75 minutes, I prefer to go with like 30 slides. Okay, so we covered fine-grained password policies too. Next thing here is group-managed service accounts. In Windows Server 2008, I think.
2008 R2.
R2. In R2, Microsoft introduced this notion of a managed service account, which is managing his own passwords in the same interval as the computer account would change his password. Computer account, as users, also have passwords, and they need to be updated once in a while. And service accounts here are also, or in Windows Server 2008 R2, you were able to create a service account, which is basically running locally on a server, which is managing the password change interval. But you couldn't use the same service account if it was updating his password on a regular basis across multiple machines. So you were able to group those service accounts. For example, if you had multiple IIS servers, which were going back after the same database, then you were able to create one account per system or per server, and then group those together and give them rights on SQL. But there was not a possibility to have them on multiple machines. And in Windows Server 2012, you're now able to create the thing. It's called a group managed service account. And this is a single security principle. It's also running in Active Directory, and actually a service on Active Directory is taking care of this GKDS is taking care of changing the password, notifying the machines which are running, or actually the machines are calling there, and they are kind of synchronizing the passwords into their local settings and services settings, which is a great benefit for those here who have service accounts running across multiple machines but don't want to change the passwords manually. Because being honest and working with a lot of customers, I've seen that changing service accounts is still a scenario where people are kind of scared and you never know what, do I need to restart the service afterwards and where areas do I need to reset the password. So I think it's a great feature that we are able to take care of those automatically now too. The requirement here is as easy that we need an Active Directory schema update in the forest. We need at least one Windows Server 2012 DC. So I always find it very nice if we have new features and we only need a certain set of machines to enable those new features to our enterprise and then carry on with the migration. And we have a slide at the end where we will explain what you need, how many DCs and stuff like this you need to enable which features. So I think it's great. You just need one domain controller here. For sure, you need to run the schema update first, and then you are able to manage your GMSAs, which are either running on Windows 8 clients or Windows Server 2012 member servers. The last new feature I want to talk about is Active Directory replication and topology commandlets. So in the past versions of the operating system, we got more and more PowerShell commandlets in there, which is, in my opinion, a very good thing. Before, when I was writing scripts for customers, I was always using a combination from VBScript, which was controlling the flow, but sometimes there were CMD commands which were more easier to issue, or it was very, very bulky to get to certain functions using VBScript. And being able to mix, I was able to provide the best scripts for my customers. But on the other hand, it's kind of hard to manage, and sometimes you have to make sure that those commands are available locally if you deploy the scripts using group policy and those things. So it's bulky. And now we have, or in Windows Server 2008 R2, we got the Active Directory PowerShell commandlets. They were good, but they were somehow limited, so you weren't easily able to create sites, site links, those things, control replication, do all those things what rep admin is doing. We have rep admin, we have NTDS util, we have certain commands there. So rep admin requires a knowledge of a lot of parameters. NTDS util is mostly used in an interactive mode where you enter NTDS util first and then you issue the next commands, and you are also able to script it, but then the command line is again getting very long, beneficial for scheduled tasks, but also covered tomorrow for some scenarios. So now we have a lot of commandlets in PowerShell which allow us to go into there. Okay, I think I make this short now because let's head over to Sam. And one issue I had at customers, or one question I had was if users are buying their own clients and they are coming back into the enterprise, will our KMS or key management system also activate them, and how can we protect from those? And Sam actually has the answer for you. Thank you.
Thanks, Ulf. I really appreciate Ulf joining me today. You know, he's a really active and valuable MVP, so thank you again.
Thank you.
So again, as Ul mentioned, KMS was something that people looked at it and said, wow, it's a little difficult for us to just deploy and manage. It is a turnkey solution, but it's a little hard for us. It's clunky, requires, you know, RPC authentication. So in Windows Server 2012, now you can use your existing Active Directory infrastructure where KMS is kind of integrated. You can still coexist with the existing KMS server because there are certain reasons that you might need it for down-level volume licensing requirements. But over a period of time, all of KMS kind of goes away and everything is Active Directory-based, and it requires a single contact with a Microsoft activation service. And domain join machines can automatically get activated. I'm going to skip that and jump into a few Kerberos enhancements because that's interesting. So in terms of the background, you know, Kerberos is fairly secure, but there are certain cases where You know, we know that offline dictionary attacks can be done, and you can spoof Kerberos errors. So as part of continuing to improve the security of that, we now have introduced what's known as FAST, Flexible Authentication Secure Tunneling. Now, this provides a protected channel between the client and the KDC in terms of being able to get a service ticket. So it is bound by, so think of this as channel binding with your computer's shared secret, so that on a domain joined machine, the communications between the KDC client and the KDC server is even more secure. This, again, can be configured through a variety of ways to support the need for you not to have to move to a functional level. Like I said in the beginning, we really tried in earnest to light up functionality without forcing customers to move to new functional levels. So you can say if you have enough DCs to support those newer clients, which is then you can turn this on so that the clients can then start enabling and accessing them. Or you have policies to say always require, which means all clients will essentially use this mechanism. As I mentioned. All right. How many of you have had challenges with Kerberos constraint delegation? All right. Looks like there's quite a few. So one of you probably in your environment, you support tiered applications. So there's always one account wanting to call on behalf of another account. and it's okay for it to be privileged. So you set this up. It was always difficult to set up. But the challenges that you had with it today was that it was limited to the front-end account as well as the back-end account, back-end service, all being within the a resource domain. A typical usage case happens to be about this being on the extranet, all right? And typically your extranet happens to be on a different domain. So you accept a credential and you need to talk to a back-end service, and it's very hard to do. So with... In Windows Server 2012, we've totally worked on making this a lot more flexible and easier to use, where it does not matter as long as you have a trusted set of forests. Excuse me. You can essentially traverse across these domain and trust boundaries and be able to enable Kerberos constraint delegation. There's a series of white papers and technical articles that will be popping up on TechNet, so you should be able to see this pretty soon. All right, dynamic access control. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you have all of these goodness in directory data that you can potentially use for authorization. But unfortunately, we force you with limited ways to be able to do authorization in Windows. So what we did was we enhanced the core capabilities, and this was across multiple teams. It was us, the AD team. It was the file server team. It was the core security team that owned the core KDC client portions in Windows. And we upgraded that overall infrastructure to now be claims aware. So now, instead of just only having SIDs within your Windows token, you now have the ability to express a lot more information that can be sourced from the directory data. A standard example is the finance department. You need to authorize something to people only in the finance department. Now, typically, you have or someone who is part of a certain cost center or someone who's part of a certain country. Typically, you have all of this data already available in your directory. We now provide you the controls and the infrastructure to be able to create policies such that you can push this information into your token, as well as, and if you right-click, for example, if you were authorizing any piece of data, you can now have, within your ACL editor, the ability to express it in far more granular way that says that if a resource can only be accessed by a user who is of department equals finance. That's the level of capabilities that we have introduced into the core Windows infrastructure. Now, another key piece. Now, fundamentally, where this came from is customers struggling to do file server management. So we produced a series of things as part of driving that as the first workload that we're lighting up with this infrastructure. And we enhanced that such that we've introduced this notion of central access policies. You can create, for example, imagine you are in information security. You can create a global policy that says all my finance data can only be accessed by my finance department or from a full-time employee. We provide you the ability to create these global policies and push them to the necessary file servers through standard mechanisms like group policy, and such that file servers can now consume them and will ensure that any authorization that happens when a user accesses a file will abide by these rules. So this gives an organization or the administrators a lot more control in being able to centralize certain things and apply it when you have hundreds of file servers to deal with. So as you can see, we introduced that. The new Active Directory Administrative Center has this something called Dynamic Access Control, where you can create these claims, figure out where you can source this data from, and create these central policies. So a few more things about Dynamic Access Control is that now we have the notion of being able to match in these policies. We can match, saying, for resources where sensitivity level equals HPI, do write authorization is only for users whose department is of finance. That's the level of granularity that we give you, and we provide you the necessary tools where a lot of this infrastructure can be seen either through an ACL editor or through the administrative Active Directory Administrative Center and provide that for you. But not only that, we've also provided, as part of this, to improve our auditing infrastructure. The fundamental challenge with auditing, especially when relating to files, was the fact that it was extremely voluminous. To actually make sense of these audits really was hard, and you had to drive towards fairly building custom solutions or driving towards complex reporting mechanisms to get the data that you need. Now, the auditing mechanism is improved in terms of using these form of, think of these as upgraded ACLs. Upgraded ACLs that have more than SIDs in them, all right? These, so an audit infrastructure is typically through a SACL. So the SACL also has these upgraded policy, of, if I may say so, where I can say audit only if a resource is mark sensitive, or audit anything that is accessed by an employee that is not a full-time employee. That's the level of flexibility we give you so that you can control, because you probably know what you really want to audit. We give you that control, and if you've done the right things to manage your data, you have a lot of control in terms of controlling your audits. All right? So I'm going to skip this. I've already mentioned this. It's not clicking further. All right. So in review, we've done a series of things in terms of listening to our customers, so please keep that feedback coming to us, because we continue to kind of evolve based on the feedback that we get from you. So we focused a lot on making our deployment simpler. We focused a lot in taking what we started with ADAC and continuing to improve it in terms of UI improvements, in terms of providing better management capabilities. We focused on providing a series of platform changes based on specific problems, like thinking about group GMSA, thinking about Kerberos constraint delegation, improving our security in Kerberos. These are a series of things that we have. We've improved our PowerShell capabilities for making it easier for you to manage. And in addition, we've kind of embraced the notion of virtualization in domain controllers by making it safer, as well as providing you the new set of capabilities to clone domain controllers to make it easy for you to deploy as well. And that really improves potentials for a much quicker disaster recovery solution. So as Ulf and I mentioned earlier, we worked hard on trying to make sure that a lot of functionality gets lit up without moving to any functional levels. So there are a series of things. So, for example, if you on the first domain member, you get a series of functionality with our set of management capabilities because we've got ADAC that is has all of these capabilities. So if you're on a Win8 machine, for example, with the RSAC installed, you can get all of those set of capabilities that you see above. Similarly, on a file server, that is a Win8 server, you can get these advancements. As I said, think of it as ACL++, where we've introduced this new policy to do that, and you can get all of those benefits in terms of having finer-grained authorization. With the first DC, we light up a series of new functionality, including dynamic access control. You see KCD, GMSA, our virtualization aspects, which also requires it to be on a PDC, and of course that kind of, we say for cloning that we require PDC. So we really worked hard to kind of ensure that we didn't have functional levels. There are a couple of cases though. This is in terms of if we need to do dynamic access control across a multi-forest environment that you have, there are certain things that make it simpler if you actually move it to a, especially the root domains to be moved to the domain level of Windows Server 2012. So that's the only key thing that we did because there were way too many cases where things could go wrong. So we said, okay, we'd rather have a simpler story rather than customers essentially getting it wrong out there and getting inconsistent results. So that's the only place that we opted to actually go do this. So I hope this gives you a good overview of Active Directory, and I hope you enjoyed this session. So I do have a session focused on virtualization right after this, and I think it's in Hall 1 of 10A or 10B, one of those. And we also have a Q&A, so if you have detailed questions, we can take it out there, or I will be right after that Q&A session. I'll be happy to answer more questions. Thank you.